I'm going to be talking about this weak lensing survey we undertook called the Deep Lens Survey. We kind of piggyback on the integrations of the survey, a transient search. So a lot of the work was done by myself, but again, a lot of the setup was done by Dave Whitman, Tony Tyson, and Vera at Davis. They're in charge of the weak lensing part. I got a great amount of help from Derek Norman at CTIO, and a lot of help from Ian Del Antonio as far as some of our other observations. So this is what a typical deep lens survey field looks like. It's designed to do weak lensing science. So this is a reasonable field of view, I guess, for such a survey. That's a fraction of a degree on a side. And we took multiple colors. We took images of multiple colors to get photometric redshifts for the sources. And we took multiple images of each field so we could build up the depth. To go out on redshift so we could do not just weak lensing measurements, but also weak lensing tomography. So if instead of co-editing those images like I showed you, different to them, you find kind of where the action is. This is all the stuff that happens in a given field of the sky, right? We have a lot of asteroids, tons of asteroids, you have variable stars, supernovae, and it's kind of in this background where we want to search for optical transients. And it's going to kind of be this limit of well-sampled data that LSST and PanSTARRS are going to be operating in.
In this fog of Luhrmann lie the transients.
That's right, somewhere in there. So essentially, I mean, a lot of the problem is recognizing what is interesting in this stuff. You can subtract off the DC sources, as you do in this difference image, but then you have to also kind of recognize amongst all the prosaic variability the really cool stuff. So the Deep Lens Survey ran from 1999 to 2005. We took some images last year, but the transient search didn't operate. It was just kind of cleaning up missing fields. Again, the area and filters, but not the cadence, were designed to do weak lensing science. And we actually kind of manipulated the cadence, designed the cadence to do a transient search. So we used a custom built near real-time difference imaging pipeline. So it was custom built in the sense that we wrote software to kind of chain together modules to do difference imaging, remapping, photometry, that sort of stuff. That was written in Python. We also used a Java-based kind of pipeline backbone called Opus. And it was a much more serious pipeline, but it was much less flexible. Near real time in this sense means we had a latency of a couple hours between measurements on the telescope and actually reporting to the community. These pipelines actually ran at the telescope, right? So we had computers in the domes of the Kitt Peak and CTIO 4-meter telescopes, and we had the astronomers who were observing there actually running this pipeline. So they're taking the data, looking at the transients, and making judgment calls at 3 a.m. So it was not always the smoothest operation. But what we did is we automatically released all information we possibly found in these data in real time or in near real time to the web. So all of our asteroids, all of our supernovae, all of our short time scale transients landed on the web as quickly as we could possibly get them out there. So we classified them and released the data. As examples of stuff that we found and stuff we had to wade through to find the more interesting transients, we found things that varied on the time scale of months, long time scale transients. Right? This is a typical difference image sequence. We have a template image, which was taken, say, a year ago. We have a science image, which was taken 10 minutes ago. We subtract them, and we find in the difference imaging a supernova. So we found supernovae are things that at least vary on month-long time scales with clear hosts, like this guy. We also found events that actually came out of nowhere. We did not find, to very deep limiting magnitude, 27th magnitude, a host. And we found this particular one who varied on month timescales and looked pretty similar to a type 2 supernova as well. We did find, which I'll talk about in more detail later, short timescale transients. Here is, again, a template image, a science image, and a difference image. If you look at a difference image from a science image that was taken 10 minutes later, we found that this particular object had flared. And if you look at it, that should be 20 minutes there. It had faded but not disappeared. So we actually found fully resolved short timescale transients like this one. But we also found unresolved short timescale transients like this guy below. So here in the template image, there's nothing. We find one guy here in the science image, which pops up in the difference image. In the next difference image, it's gone. Okay, so we got one image of this particular event. So it lasted less than an exposure time, if it was real. Right. Cosmic rays are always the bugaboo when we're trying to figure out what's going on with the single epoch transients. We have asteroids, right? If you have an asteroid in the template image, and then you have one in the science image, you get this nice little dipole here. This also kind of indicates that if you're doing automatic classification, you can't always assume that something next to a galaxy is a supernova. Asteroids pass over these guys all the time. And if you have KBOs, you'll have something here in the template image, in the science image, kind of a small dipole which is slowly moving outwards as a function of time. KBOs are actually another really big background. If you're using a template image that was taken, you know, say a year ago, and you look at this part of the sky and there's KBOs in it, they can look like stationary, real transients. And as well, as for LSST, asteroids are going to look pretty point-like, given the exposure times are only 10 seconds or so. So the particulars of the DLS imaging are here. The entendu, which is kind of this new way of looking at things, it describes your ability to go deep and wide simultaneously, of the Kitt Peak and 4 meter Kitt Peak and CTIO 4 meter telescopes. It's 3.5 meters squared degrees squared. For comparison, LSST's entendu is in the hundreds, 200-300. I'm sure Jolka knows the exact number.
321.
321, there we go. The field of view for the entire survey is, we have five fields. Each of these is 4 square degrees. These were obtained in, or each field was observed in a 3x3 set of images, each of which was 0.6 by 0.6 square degrees. We observed in B, V, R, and Z. And we hit each subfield, I should say, 20 times per filter over the course of the entire five-year survey. We had exposure times of 600 seconds in B, V, and Z, and 900 seconds in R. And our limiting exposure was about the 23rd magnitude. You guys have seen, again, plots like this. This is essentially as a function of separation in time on this axis. How many times do we look at a given part of the sky with this separation in time? Right. So you can see most of our sensitivity was to things around 10 to the third seconds. And we essentially accomplished this by doing a five-image dither for a given part of the sky. So we'd point to a part of the sky and to fill in gaps between ships, so we'd dither around in a five-image pattern. And so we have this number of 3.7 square degree days, not years, square degree days, at this 10 to the 3 second time scales. But again, the important thing is this is down to 23rd, 24th magnitude. Okay. We have also sensitivity to fields where we observed, we came back the next night, we came back the next month, and we came back the next year. But the really cool, important, really fun stuff is actually happening here. So I'm going to now go through three of the interesting optical transients we found in the Deep Lens survey, again at these short timescales. The first one was 2001-03-26. This takes place, by coincidence or not, in the field of an Abel cluster, a pretty low redshift. Abel 1836 at a redshift of 0.037. You can see here's the cluster. There's kind of in the guts of it, there's a really bright star, which is magnified up here. And next to it, there's this guy, which is actually the quiescent image. So this is the host of the flaring event. Okay. On the right side here, we have its light curve. So in one exposure, we had actually limiting magnitude of almost 24.5, it looks like. We found it was a null detection. We then, in our very next exposure, found this thing flaring at 23rd magnitude almost. And it decayed really rapidly, and we came back to it in R about 2,500 seconds later, and it was not there. If you look at the B band data, the power law index the power law index is around 1 or so. It was really tough to tell because again the time scale of the events are very similar to the actual exposure time. We alerted on this event at T plus 0.2 days, so it was a pretty rapid alert, near real time. We got VLA follow-up by Dale Frail at T plus 4 days, and there was a null detection at that point in time of minus 0.1 plus or minus 0.3 millijanskis. We tracked down HST archival observations of this cluster that were taken in 1995. And the host actually showed up. Again, that small object was in these archival observations. And it was unresolved in the HST imaging. Okay, so it's very likely a point source. We were able to set proper motion limits on it of 0.04 arc seconds a year, plus or minus 0.04 arc seconds. And the host is red. Okay, we didn't detect it in the B bands at all. Limiting magnitude of 26.4. In the V, it's 24.5, and the V-R color is like 1.2. Okay? So again, this thing being unresolved, it gives you the thought that it's a star, okay? And if it's a star, it's probably a flaring M-dwarf. The complication with that, I guess, is that this thing is so dim, and the proper motion is so low, it'd have to be a halo, thick disk or halo M-dwarf. And these are not known to flare. And you guys should parse that. These are known not to flare, but they're not known to flare. Okay, there's a difference. But there's no thought to be age-activity relationship for these M-dwarf stars, right? And if it's in the halo, it's likely older, and those are less active than the younger companions or younger brethren. The second one was OT 2002-0115. This one again, here's the light curve on the right. We found it in the B band. We had a constraining observation here of around 25th magnitude. We then saw it flare up to, you know, 20, almost 21st magnitude in the B. And it dropped off to 24 by the next 600 second exposure. Okay, so we resolved this one again. And we thought we knew what we were doing, right? We released a GCN on this, 1217. We thought we found a really cool guy. We got spectroscopic follow-up, Alejandro Cocchiati, at T plus 3 days. We got a spectrum of this, and it was actually an M-dwarf. So this, I think, is going to provide the biggest background to any optical transient search are going to be these M-dwarf stars. They've, you know, not just fooled us, they've also fooled the Catalina Sky Survey, who had a GCN on a similar sort of thing not too long ago. And our third and most cool optical transient was this one here. It's OT 2003-0305. The actual image sequence corresponding to this optical transient is shown here. So this is the first observation at T minus 700 seconds in the V band. You can see there's an empty hole right there. And in our first detection, we actually found it here in the V band on the very edge of a chip, which is unfortunate. But we got it again at 700 seconds after the first observation in the V band. And we immediately got a second sequence of observations in the B-band. And you can see it evolving there. And by 2.5 days later, it was gone. And so again, here's the light curve. We have the constraining observation, the V-band observations here, and then the B-band observations there. So either, you know, this change, this light curve indicates there was either flickering in the event or some kind of, you know, spectral evolution. So, you know, we made actually a mistake with this one. We did not get immediate follow-up. We released it via the IAU circulars, and that was a horrible decision. You know, there was, of course, days of wrangling with Dan June about this. So we dropped this on the floor. That was really bad. We were actually able to go back, and we stacked up all the images in the VRNI, and we found that there's a host, and it's very likely to be extended. Okay, so here is the R in the I in the Z-band. So all these three guys here are the host in the stacked images. And if we measure the shape of the object in the R-band, we find it's inconsistent with the point spread function at 99% confidence. So it's pretty likely that this is an extended object. And you know, this is the software that we used to do weak lensing, and we're pretty certain that this is a legitimate measurement. And again, this is also faint in red, right? We don't see this thing in B or V. In R, it's 24.6, and in R minus Z, it's 3.2. So it's an extremely red host.
Is it Vega or AB?
These are Vega magnitudes. And you know, they're extremely, it's extremely dim, and it's extremely tough to get time to follow these guys up spectroscopically because they are so dim, in fact. So here are the overall constraints on these 1,000-second optical transients. These are, you know, I guess in the parlance of Grunfeld and his followers, known unknowns, perhaps even a known known, if you count flare stars. But the precursors for these were faint in red, and the events are generally faint in blue. We didn't actually detect any events in the R-band. We found them all in B and V. Okay, so in this brightness range between B of 18.6 and 23.8 Vega magnitudes, we find a rate of 4.3 optical transients per square degree per day, which is, I mean, compared to the ROTCE, it's completely different than the ROTCE results. And I suspect it's got to be the extra depth that we're adding on the survey. We have 2.2 flares per square degree per day, stellar flares from M-dwarf stars, if you count that one event. On the V-band, if you count this one that we saw in both B and V, the rate's 2.1, and we found nothing in the R-band. So the interesting thing is this analysis, this real-time analysis, only really included 40% of the overall DLS data set. So we're going through and doing a global reanalysis right now, which should uncover several new of these optical transients. And we'll also get some constraints in the Z-band. It turns out we didn't actually difference those in real-time because we had fringing. We didn't do real-time fringing corrections. This is too much of a pain to observe and do defringing and do the reductions and scan the transients, etc. So that should be very important. And I think, you know, the thing that we really need to do for this is find we can't follow up the events, but we can actually start looking at their hosts. We can study the properties of the hosts of these transients, which will give you an idea of what the heck's actually going on. It will answer the very important question, what fraction of these things are actually flaring dwarf stars? Which of these things are extragalactic or some other sort of phenomena? Will we find hosts that are bright enough for follow-up? So this has, again, been one of the biggest things, is getting spectral time to follow up these hosts. They are, again, so dim. And so we don't know the distances. We don't really know the energy budgets for these events. So I'm going to go through and talk about some of the lessons learned, I think, from this, okay, from this survey. Is, you know, the big thing is we need to reject all this prosaic variability, right? All this boring stuff, the variable stars, the asteroids. In particular, those things that are going to masquerade as optical transients are flare stars. Again, this is the GCN, which got the Catalina guys, and as well as KBOs. They're going to look like stationary objects in your field. Now, to do this, I mean, we really need to kind of collectively as a community work on real-time detection and classification schemes, okay? So we need to, you know, collaborate with statisticians and computer scientists and figure out how to, you know, represent what a supernova is in data, at the pixel level, at the light curve level, etc. This is the next big, I think, advance that we need to make collectively as a field. Again, for most surveys, a lot of this stuff is done by hand. The event rate is really low compared to the, you know, collecting area that we have in these telescopes. So it makes it difficult to pre-schedule spectroscopic follow-up like the supernova surveys do, right? These people can go to, you know, CTIO and take enough data to ensure that someone at Keck has a spectrum or a supernova candidate or two to follow up. We can't do that yet, not with the current surveys. And the informal follow-up arrangements are really inadequate. I mean, you can call Keck and try to, you know, wrangle someone's arm to get you spectroscopic data, but that's not always going to happen. You can't be guaranteed someone in this room who cares about this stuff is going to be there. VO event would have helped immensely. This kind of disseminating this information would have been, I mean, it would have been a godsend. But it still wouldn't have really solved the spectroscopic follow-up issue. I don't think Keck's going to necessarily be signed up to VO event to slew itself over to whatever comes through the pipeline. But importantly, optically transient events are out there, okay? We are seeing these things. We see temporally resolved events, right, things where we have multiple observations. We have small numbers, so the rates are really uncertain. There are temporarily unresolved events where you see it in a single image, okay? And you have to make the argument this is not a cosmic ray, this is in fact a real PSF, essentially. But the cool thing is these next generation surveys should find hundreds per night. And the really interesting thing is we need to quantify the brightness and timescale distributions of these, you know, again, known optical transients, right? And that will answer the question, what is the optimal survey strategy? If you have time, do you spend it going deeper because there's more things fainter? Or do you spend it going wider because there's more things, you don't get as many by going deeper, essentially. To this end, some of us, or Paul Price and I, have started a small campaign on the CFHC plus Megacam to essentially just look at a set of four fields over and over again. So we were observed four nights, four runs, I should say. We're going to cycle between four fields, 16 times in an evening, just to see what shows up. We got 185 second exposures in the R prime band. They have not been reduced yet. Paul's also working with Rob Jedecky, who is doing TALX, which is an asteroid rotation survey. And they're cycling between 12 fields, so they're going wider, but in only 20 second exposure, so not quite as deep. The next generation surveys, of course, LSST, which is going to be in space, and PanSTARRS, should find, you know, literally hundreds of these things per night at these 1,000 second timescales. And the question is, how many do you find at 10 second timescales? How many at 100 second timescales? Again, this stuff's not known yet. Whatever they do must enable immediate spectroscopic follow-up. If you want to get the redshift to these guys, I mean, that's something that's got to be done. And they must generate alerts that encode in them the confidence levels. We think this is 50% likely an optical transient, 10% possibly a supernova, 50% possibly a KBO. You know, and it should be really buyer beware, right? We should give these people the best estimate of what we think this is and let them risk their telescope time on it or not. And, you know, again, these numbers shouldn't necessarily add to one because there are going to be some things that your data models aren't going to be able to represent. For example, this. That's it.
Question or comment? In your webpage, you call transient anything that's not the same, including small variation in brightness of stars and obvious asteroids. When you say transient in this talk, do you mean real transient?
I mean optical transients, capital O, capital T.
It wasn't there, and it's there only once, and then gone after a couple exposures?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Now, we do call things asteroids and KBOs, or slow movers, I should say, and supernovae and variable stars.
On the webpage, you make effort to call them names, but they're all lumped on one webpage.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And comment is that, you know that, but others don't, that we took pictures with Keck of a couple of the fields of what I would say are genuine transients,
mm-hmm.
and in both cases, there is what looks like a faint galaxy. In one case, we tried to get redshift, but there are no obvious emission lines, and that means nothing at all. So at least some fraction of genuine faint fast transients are of cosmological distances, and they're not flaring red stars.
So I'll follow also with a question and a comment. I guess the comment being, I've seen at least a few papers that have addressed the issue of stair versus tile for finding objects. And so I'm a bit surprised to hear you say that nothing has been done in that area, that we need to quantify timescales and distributions. I thought some of that work had already been done. It was just a matter of picking your favorite distribution.
Well, I think you're talking about the paper by Robert Nemiroff.
Yeah.
Right? It's like tile stair.
That's at least one of them.
Yeah, how do you spend your time? So that depends upon what is the timescale of the things you're looking for. And so that's unknown. So the actual distribution of timescales of actual events are unknown, because that will set your survey strategy.
So then the question is, regarding the transit you found toward the Abel cluster, any possibility that can be microlensing?
I thought about lensing, yes. It seemed the timescale is so short, but I just don't think the cost could move across that. I don't think the cost of moving that fast. It was 1,000 seconds. But it didn't seem reasonable for a few things.
You were talking about you could have very fast changes due to very small masses.
But this thing would have to move.
There is a transient that's turned out published behind one of the Bell clusters, which is also U-band dropout.
Yeah, the PALS.
They made a case that it is an accretion flare at the redshift of 3, which would be lensed.
Yeah. Well, this thing has a clear host, so, right? The host is there, it's unresolved in the
system. Okay. So, some searches have a particular science goal, and they completely focus on that internally, do it, and they're proud of it. The other approach is to sort of do a little bit of what the DLS was doing at the time, just sort of put it all out there, right? And you get some very interesting things, and you get some people unhappy because they lose tech time on nothing. Or, you know, and this will continue to be an issue of politics, as well as discussing scarce resources and all these things. It's not just easy enough to say, oh, my garbage might be interesting to someone else. My garbage is someone else's garden, as was earlier mentioned, because that person's going to be unhappy because you actually just threw them a lot of garbage. This issue of general classification is really hard, and it's non-trivial, and it's very different to do a targeted search for something in this general sort of thing. I mean, do you have any great insight about how this should be done, or yes, it's hard?
Well, I mean, we need to collaborate with statisticians who do this sort of thing all the time. I mean, they do a lot of, you know, pixel-based image classification. What is this? You know, people do it with cartoons, people do it with, you know, Defense Department satellites. And it's just a matter of, you know, us holding their hands and vice versa and trying to make this happen.
And do you have political suggestions for organizations of how we should think about this community? And also balance individually, you know, how is this going to work out?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Well, he said the right things. First of all, you need to have classification. And second, the VO event framework is the right framework in which to do that, where you associate your best guess probabilities of event classification and let people decide if the probability of their favorite event is high enough for them to spend spectroscopic time. So then let market forces drive it.
Yeah, I mean, just an extension of that is not only do you have to not have to know exactly what it is, but presumably if you put out your metadata, whatever that is, R band this, before it wasn't this, with this time scale, if there is a real need to go after transients of interesting sorts, people will create their own machines which will make decisions about what these sources are with some probabilistic output. So you could imagine if you are publicizing all of these events as VO events, and you say, I don't know what these are, there could be a machine which actually is designed that has the collective understanding of the community about all the different sorts of things you might see. And that could be the thing that we all ask about. We all pull.
Yeah, I think in that case, you might want to even be able to include fix files, right? Can you send fix files along with these things? Because people are going to want the pixel level information.
You can tag it. I mean, you can put a link to it.
Through URL, right. I think that would be necessary.
Sure. Yeah, okay, I know about getting statisticians involved and so on. I think that's kind of futuristic. It's only meaningful if you understand what the phenomena is.
this is not a question of mathematics, okay? It's a question of, so I would say the first thing maybe people in this community should actually know about stars, because whether they like it or not, these, you know, the Houdini star is a well-known phenomenon, and maybe people knew this literature. So I think that's more needed than doing some amazing DOD analysis on this sort of stuff. And anyway, so let me make a scientific comment. The DLS survey, it's very interesting that your biggest success in B-band. I think that's telling you the whole story.
Yeah, I agree. Find nothing in there.
Yeah. Let me make a challenge to the optical observers who are looking for a transient. There should be a class of transient associated with gamma ray bursts, but not of the kind that people have been looking for, in the sense of afterglow, like some nice smooth power law decay, but just transient associated with the front gamma ray emission in the following sense. We know that in the case of gamma ray bursts, we have got flux off order of maybe 0.1 to 1 millijansky in the gamma ray band, and a peak between tens of keV to hundreds of keV, and energy, the spectrum below the peak, which varies from burst to burst, but something like nu minus half is pretty common. So based on that, we expect that there should be some flux in the optical to eV. The extrapolation of nu minus half probably is not going to continue to optical band, but one can fold variety of different possibility, and you will be still getting something like a millijansky in the optical band associated with from gamma ray emission. The light curve isn't going to be nice, smooth, decaying power law. It may have rise, it will have fluctuations. So there will be certain different kind of transient optical light that ought to be there, should be there. Associated with gamma ray bursts. So the challenge is for optical observers to go out and look for these things. If they don't find, I think that's
we are.
You
saw one, I guess.
That was in the IR, but these guys will see.
There's another one. There's a Nature paper that's been submitted.
We'll show you another one tomorrow. Yeah. I haven't seen that, but Peridot is something that I certainly know that you guys found one case, but you know, there should be a lot of these things.
Yeah, you need a good fraction of the sky, and I think, you know, Panstar and LSST will do just that. It's something that LSST is certainly keeping a very strong eye on. We're going to try to get these alerts out as quickly as possible to the community.
Well, there's room for every kind. Raptor is a different phase space, which is what Pawan is talking about. LSST and Panstar is a different phase space. I think they are doing what you want. Maybe, you know, Nature has not blessed them with enough events, but it's happening.
Yeah,
but,
can you
make a
comment on this?
Will
you make a comment on this?
Part of the curse with classification is that you're trying to estimate densities in a very high dimensional space. So I think it makes sense at some level to throw at it better statistics. But
he just didn't understand.
I agree that you need also to know what you're
you know, fine. It's all talk. Why did actually do the observations?
Yeah, we agree. Let's just do it.
Well, I think a bit caught in the middle between Josh Bloom's comments and Michael's comments. Because imagine you are a certain customer, say, you know, LIGO, perhaps hypothetically, and we would like to, say, take a preferred supernova as a master, meaning as a trigger, and then a LIGO be the slave, rather than vice versa. Well, then coming back to Sri's comments, I think it would be well appreciated if there was some effort on the, you know, real observer's part in trickling down the data to say, well, this has a certain likelihood to be a supernova. And on top of that, also give perhaps some educational information on the light curve and say, well, this is the best estimate for the T0. All of this is really an opportunity to find new customers for your production. And in fact, by some specialized input, make it much easier and user-friendly for to be observations, taking advantage of your data. I don't think that will happen just by itself. Mm-hmm. And how this to arrange politically, maybe you have to soften it up a little bit by, you know, arranging some kind of joint workshop like this one to glue everything together.
Well, we actually did something sort of like this for LSST. We had a workshop, which was a community access workshop, which we said, you know, come to Seattle and tell us what you want from these data and we'll try to enable
that. Yeah, I think that's very necessary. It's sort of a user group, if you wish, which is a familiar concept in parallel computing, but then for this kind of results.
Yeah, this last comment when Josh comments really connect together when Josh said that if you just put out your metadata, then people will write their own machines and engines which will interpret that data. But we essentially need to seek people who can do that if there are people out there and make them do that. So if in case the transients come, we are all ready with that and help them out.
They reward them, career wise.
Any other questions? Let's thank this speaker one more time.